Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Always a pleasure to have your company on this edition of Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideo in Bonn, Germany. In this program, an expert on HIV attending the World AIDS Conference in Australia stresses the importance of knowing one's HIV status.
In many countries, the rate of people who don't know their infection is over 50%, and obviously that harbors a big risk of transmitting HIV to other people.
What was behind Sunday's deadly attack in Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa?
They left behind leaflets warning particular community. This seems to be a move to try and incite one community against the other.
And of course, we shall air the learning by ear drama looking at legal and illegal migration to Europe. Stay with Africa Link.
Top story.
Global challenge. UNAIDS Director Dr. Michelle Sidibe has called on the world to end the HIV pandemic by 2030. He was addressing 12,000 delegates from around 200 countries during the opening of the 20th International AIDS Conference in Melbourne, Australia. The event began with a moment of silence in honour of colleagues killed in the Malaysia Airlines crash en route to the conference. HIV experts say new infections have dropped and those infected are living longer thanks to antiretroviral therapy. But there is still no cure or vaccine for HIV in sight. Jürgen Rockstroh is Professor of Medicine and Head of the HIV Outpatient Clinic at the University of Bonn in Germany. He's attending the conference and has been telling me where we are in the fight against HIV.
In the plenary session, there was something like defined as, you know, epidemic control. So it may not be possible to get everyone on treatment, but at least, you know, 90% and maintaining that the number of new infections remains very limited. And I think there are several things around that. And that means that in order to get everyone on treatment, we have to upscale identifying or diagnosing people who have HIV. In many countries, the rate of people who don't know their infection is over 50%, and obviously that harbors a big risk of transmitting HIV to other people. And if we would have, you know, easier access and very cheap point-of-care tests which allow rapid diagnosis at a not-so-costly manner, we could increase the number of patients on treatment. So I think that's one of the big issues. How can we roll out HIV testing? And that is so closely associated with human rights, right? So if there's stigmatization, if HIV infection diagnosis leads to exclusion from society or there's no access to treatment, well, then no one will be tested. So I think it's also around, you know, changing stigma and criminalization around HIV.
What is the biggest challenge of healthcare professionals trying to combat HIV, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa?
What I'm learning here is it's really a lot around getting to identify everyone who has HIV. I think that's probably the biggest challenge. I think that the ARV programs in place are all very successful. Obviously, there's some issues around stockouts and making sure that once people are on therapy, that they can remain on therapy. So there's still cost issues and availability of drugs. But I think above all, it's really trying to fight against some of the more social and political limitations in the upscaling of programs, which could be that the resources are not directed towards access to therapy, or resources are not directed to making diagnosis of HIV easier, or it could just be that patients with HIV are stigmatized or criminalized, and that sort of then prevents further spread of take of diagnostics. And there was a very moving scene at the opening ceremony. A lady who was infected with HIV very early, I think at age 15 or so, said, "If I would have known what HIV is, if I would have been educated, I would have not become infected." So it's not only distributing medicine or developing great medicine, it's also giving education so that everyone knows what HIV is all about. And I think that was a very powerful message to highlight that if we want to end the epidemic, we also have to educate everyone what HIV is and how it's transmitted.
HIV expert Professor Jürgen Rockstroh on the line from Melbourne. Uganda now has the highest percentage of new HIV infections in Eastern Africa. That's according to a report by UNAIDS. Until recently, Uganda had been the darling of the international AIDS community and was cited as an example of how to reduce the HIV prevalence rate. However, a spate of corruption scandals involving funds to fight HIV forced many donors to cut aid, thus scaling back gains already made. This report by Simone Schlindwein has been adapted for Africa Link by Mark Caldwell.
This is where Africa's first HIV/AIDS epidemic broke out in 1982. It's Kasenzero, a fishing village in southern Uganda on the shores of Lake Victoria, close to the border with Tanzania. At that time, individual cases had been reported in Tanzania, the Congo and the United States. But the high mortality rate in this village 32 years ago was very different. Joseph Konde Lule is Uganda's leading virologist. Back then, he was a newly qualified doctor. Now, he says, the main aim is to improve on existing antiretroviral therapy, which can extend the lives of sufferers.
This thing now we have are these ARVs, and the challenge is simply to better ones, meaning those with less side effects. And that is the current challenge. The cure, the complete cure, maybe sometime ahead.
In the 1990s, the percentage of the Ugandan population infected with the HIV virus used to be low compared to other African countries. Billions of dollars once flooded in from the United States and the Global AIDS Fund to help stem the disease. But then, in 2003, $40 billion disappeared from the AIDS Fund without trace. Edward Sekewa was one of the journalists who, years later, were able to establish what happened to it. Sekewa went to university in Germany and is now one of Uganda's leading anti-corruption campaigners. In Kampala, he takes us up a wind-swept hill to a residential area for the very rich.
Look at all these houses. That's the Global Fund house. It belongs to the former Minister for Health, who embezzled money from the Global AIDS Fund. That was money for AIDS sufferers, money to pay for medicine. But he simply took the money and did what he liked with it. He built houses, bought cars. It's terrible. He has now let the house to the United Nations, and he himself lives next door. Can you believe it?
In Uganda, the rate of new infections with HIV now stands at 150,000 a year, the highest in East Africa. Ereza Mugisha from Kampala's AIDS Information Centre says people have become complacent since ARVs became available, which can control the disease.
It does not immediately kill people. It gives some false hope. People who are on ARVs, if they don't adopt positive behaviour, they spread the disease because they say, I also got it from somewhere else. They don't want to die alone.
Mark Caldwell with that report compiled by Simone Schlinwein in Kampala.
Africa Link, because Africa is more than just a headline.
Broken promises. The UN mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, has accused South Sudanese rebels of violating a ceasefire agreement with President Salva Kiir. The rebels, loyal to former deputy Riek Machar, claim they had retaken Nasir, a town in Upper Nile State. However, the government has refuted those claims. The fighting, which erupted mid-December 2013, has killed hundreds and displaced at least 1 million people. I've been speaking to Simona Foltin, a freelance journalist following the events in South Sudan, on the renewed fighting.
Nasir has a symbolic and strategic importance for the rebels because it is the hometown of Riek Machar, and it could therefore present the first of a series of attacks to try to reclaim control over territories that were lost during the previous months of fighting. We have heard of conflicting statements by the government forces and the rebels about who is in control of Nasir town at this point. There are also no accurate reports of casualties, though according to some sources, around 250 fighters are said to have died. The problem here is that the ceasefire agreement in its current form is not really enforceable. The agreement does not stipulate the details, for example, of where troops should be, how armed groups should be disarmed, and more importantly, there is no enforcement or monitoring mechanism. The reality on the ground is really difficult to control. You have an increased number of armed groups, some of them acting more or less autonomously, and you also have a very high degree of armament among civilians.
So what you're saying is that Riek Machar is not totally in control.
He has, a couple of months back in an interview, he admitted to not have full control. However, even if that is the case, he has a large impact and a large amount of influence over these groups.
And previously, the Juba administration, or rather President Salva Kiir's government, had accused the UN mission in South Sudan of siding with the rebels. Has this changed now that the UN is criticizing the rebels for violating this ceasefire deal?
Both the government forces and the rebels have violated the ceasefire agreements. And certainly the United Nations has a role to simply monitor what's going on the ground. They have not sided with one or the other party. But it is a tactic of both parties to try to point fingers, to try to accuse various organizations of not representing the reality in an accurate manner.
You've been following this conflict since it erupted last year, mid-December. Who has the upper hand at the moment?
According to experts, nobody really has the upper hand right now, which some believe has been the reason why we have seen a lull in fighting over the past few months. You know, in the frontline areas around Bentiu, Malakal, Nasser, the front lines are pretty much entrenched. You have fighting here and there, which causes the front lines to shift. But there is no clear military upper hand by either side.
South Sudan freelance journalist Simona Foltin. And violence is not only happening in South Sudan. Police in Kenya's coastal city of Mombasa have arrested 8 suspects in connection with an attack which killed at least 4 people on Sunday. The attackers reportedly said it was a retaliatory attack for the Impeketoni killings. President Uhuru Kenyatta said the Impeketoni attack had targeted his Kikuyu tribesmen even after Somalia's Al-Shabaab militants claimed responsibility. From Mombasa, Eric Ponda reports.
The gunmen opened fire indiscriminately, killing 4 people on the spot. One of the casualties was an 11-year-old boy who was just walking home. 11 more people are admitted to hospitals, some of them in a critical condition. Police say the unknown gunmen escaped on foot after the attack at 9 p.m. on Sunday night. They have yet to establish their motives. Mombasa County Commissioner Nelson Marwa says police are investigating the source of hate leaflets that were found in the area targeting a certain community and asking them to leave or face dire consequences.
This seems to be an incitement, a move to try and incite one community against the other, and we are pretty aware. We have talked to the leaders, and whoever is behind this move is not going to succeed.
The leaflets contained warning that the attackers were on a mission to carry out acts of revenge for attacks in Lamu district, where over 100 people have been killed. Witnesses say the attackers arrived there armed with rifles and opened fire in the residential area before escaping. Tension is high in the area following the hate leaflets, as this brings to life the memories of similar attacks in the area 5 years ago. Likoni area, which is separated from the Mombasa island by the Likoni Creek, is an insecurity hotspot. It is where the Islamic cleric Mohammed Idris was shot dead by unknown assailants last month. And residents now are demanding answers from the government.
We want a peaceful solution to bring an end to these attacks. We want to live in peace. We don't want chaos here. We have lived here in peace for a long time, and maybe these are people out to cause chaos for their own interests.
The Sunday shooting followed another attack on Friday night in Lamu County, in which 7 people were killed, among them 4 police officers. The gunmen blocked a bus carrying passengers and another car, spraying them with bullets. Inspector General of Police David Kimayo consequently issued a dusk to dawn curfew in Lamu County that will require residents to stay indoors from 6:30 in the evening to 6:30 in the morning. Security in Mombasa has also been tightened since the Sunday attack.
Eric Ponda in Mombasa.
Deutsche Welle, learning by ear. Listen up, shape your future.
Greetings and welcome to Learning by Ear. This is the 13th episode of this ongoing radio drama about modern migration by Africans to Europe called The Promised Land. We've been following the lives of Linda, Farahani, and Chivasi, and we've seen that although Europe offers many opportunities for study and self-development, there are also many negative aspects, especially if one migrates there illegally. In the previous episode, Linda was shocked to discover that Charles, the stranger she married so she could get a work permit, was in fact Florence's ex-husband and that the two of them co-own the nightclub where Florence got her a job. But she's still thinking of dropping out of university to work more hours because she desperately needs money to help pay her father's hospital bill. At the detention center, where immigration officials have started to hear people's applications for asylum, Farahani was the first to go in and Chivasi was last. Will they succeed in getting refugee status in Europe? Stay tuned for today's episode called Under the Radar. Let's join Chivasi as he tells his story to the immigration official.
So, you're the new daredevil.
Daredevil? I don't understand. What do you mean by that, sir?
Well, you managed to sneak on board of one of our ships that was delivering food aid to Africa and make your way to Europe as a stowaway. I can't remember the last time I interviewed someone who'd done that. That makes you a bit of a hero, don't you think?
No, sir, I don't. I think it was one of the scariest things I've ever done in my life.
Oh, really? Why is that? You made it all the way to Europe undetected, and compared to most illegals who arrive in small boats, your journey must have been quite luxurious. Do you have any money with you?
Money? You mean money as in euros?
Not just euros. Cash in any currency. Do you have any?
I used to. I have a little money, yes, but not enough because I have to support a big family.
You have a family? Are you married? Do you have children?
No, I'm not married yet. I have a few. I have brothers and sisters.
A family and a fiancé, eh? You don't fit the refugee profile. How come you want to be given asylum?
Back home we had elections, and after that, there were clashes between the different ethnic groups. I fled the violence because they were targeting people from my ethnic background.
And what about your family? Aren't you afraid their lives might be in danger too?
No, yes, I'm scared for them, but I know they're fine.
How do you know that?
How? I saw them.
Before you came?
Yes.
Okay, so you said that after the elections, there were some religious clashes. Why is that?
I don't know. We've always had this problem.
What problem? I don't understand.
This religious conflict.
I thought it was ethnic.
Ethnic? Yes, ethnic and religious.
Thank you. That's enough. I'm sorry, but I don't believe that you qualify for asylum.
Huh?
Your story is inconsistent, and it seems to me that you have other reasons for coming to Europe illegally.
No.
I am rejecting your application, and you'll be deported back to Africa as soon as possible.
But how can that be? I've told you.
That'll be all for now.
There's nothing Chivasi can do but get up and walk slowly back to his room at the detention center. He's failed the test, and now he's officially awaiting deportation. But will he accept it? Meanwhile, Linda, Florence, and Charles are taking a break at the nightclub.
How's your father doing, Linda? Have you had any news?
Yes, the operation was successful, and the doctor says he's making good progress.
Right, that's cool. Now, when you leave university and come and work with us full-time, things will only get better. In a few years, the immigration department will grant you a residence permit, and you can do whatever you want.
I still can't believe it. This is all like a dream to me.
Police! Everybody freeze! Nobody leave the room!
What the hell is going on here? Huh? What's that?
You must be Florence. And this is your ex-husband Charles, isn't it? I believe you're the owners of this club?
That's correct, yeah.
And this young lady must be Linda Moraga, a university student, currently married to Charles. Am I right?
Yes. Is there a problem, officer?
We've been investigating the two of you for a long time now. You're both under arrest on suspicion of organizing fake marriages between Europeans and Africans to help them acquire European citizenship, and of forcing them to work in your club, thereby exploiting them and denying them their basic human rights. Once we present the evidence that the marriage between Linda and Charles is a sham, it will be annulled by the court. And as for you, Miss Moraga, we don't know whether you agreed to this scam of your own free will or whether you were forced into the marriage. I don't know how deeply you're involved, but there isn't enough evidence against you. You're free to go.
Officer, I swear I don't know what you're talking about. This must be a misunderstanding, eh?
Hey, Charles, relax. We are simply under suspicion. That means we are innocent until proven guilty. I don't see any evidence to show that we committed any crime either. So, let's do as the officer asks and follow him, okay?
Okay, come on now, Rickford. Come on.
Linda watches in fear and horror as Florence and Charles are led out of the club in handcuffs. Elsewhere, at the detention center for illegal migrants, Chivasi confides in Farahani, who, after his second interview, is now almost certain that he'll be granted asylum. Farahani has an idea as to what Chivasi should do next.
You're sure he told you that you definitely wouldn't get asylum?
Yes, he told me he didn't believe me. He said I contradicted myself and that in a few days they're going to send me back.
Back? Is that what you want? To go back to Africa? Because if you really want to stay, there's only one way out for you now.
What? What is it? I came all this way. I have to finish what I started. I have to see Linda. Tell me, what must I do?
Now you know you won't get asylum. You need to sleep under the radar.
Under the radar?
Yep.
You mean live here undetected?
Exactly. It's dangerous. But I know someone who knows someone. And if you tell him I sent you, he'll help you. But first, you'll have to escape from this detention center. I've been thinking a lot about how I could get out if my application was rejected. And I think I know a way.
Farahani quickly briefs Chivasi on where to go and what to do. A few hours later, Chivasi is waiting outside the main building inside the detention center when a delivery van pulls up. As soon as the driver is looking the other way, Chivasi wriggles underneath and clings to the undercarriage with all his might. Now the van is racing through the European streets, heading into the big city.
Why did I come here? Must be out of my mind. I had everything I needed at home. Linda, I hope you're waiting for me. I'll be with you soon. All this pain because of you. No, I can't hold on much longer. I have to jump now. It's now or never. Oh, my back! My back!
Hey, are you all right? Oh, no, you're bleeding. We need to call an ambulance. Wait, where are you going?
No, please, no ambulance, no police. I'll be okay. Excuse me, is this the capital? Can you tell me how I can get to the university?
The capital? Oh, no, that's a long way away. Listen, my name is Rhoda. I live nearby. Why don't you come with me if you don't go to hospital? I can treat your wounds and then you'll be on your way.
No, thank you. Hey, careful. Please. No, thank you.
No. This way. Follow me.
I need to go. I'm running out of time. I have to go.
No, not in that condition. You're bleeding. And you look like you could do with a hot bath and maybe some food. Come with me, please. I think I know what you're going through. I promise I won't do anything to hurt you, okay? I'm just going to be a good Samaritan.
Oh, no. Too late. The police are coming for me.
Hey, don't panic. Take my arm now. Walk with me.
Will Chivasi manage to dodge the police? Even if he succeeds, he has no money and no papers. How will he ever find Linda? And what about Farahani? If he's granted asylum, does that mean all his problems are solved? Join us next time for the answers to these questions and more in the following episodes of our radio drama series, The Promised Land. For now, we invite you to visit our online discussion forum at facebook.com/DW.LBE to share your opinions on what life is like for illegal migrants who have to live under the radar. If you'd like to listen to the episode again, please visit our webpage at dw.de/Destination Europe. Take care.
After that drama, now a reminder of our main stories before we go. The UN has called on the global community to end HIV infections by 2030. South Sudanese rebels have violated a ceasefire with government forces, the UN mission in South Sudan has said. And Kenyan police have arrested 8 suspects linked to Sunday's attack in Mombasa, in which at least 4 people were killed. And that's it. For comments and suggestions, write to feedback.africa@dw.de, a letter to AfricaLink, DW 53110, or an SMS to 49160 957 59510. I'm Crispin Mwakideu. Take care.